Balaam is a very interesting character, and there's a lot of nuances here, a lot of tiny little things that we need to push into and develop. So the first thing I want to talk about at the very top of the page is that term, run greedily. If you look at the various translations, you have run greedily, ran riotously, rushed headlong, and abandoned themselves. And so as you look at that and you think, wonder why the translators had so much trouble here. And then you look up the word and you realize why they had so much trouble. This is the word when Jesus said, this is the blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many unto the remission of sins. So it's the Greek word for poured out. And so when Judas fell, what happened to his bowels? They gushed out. When Jesus overturned the money changers' tables, the money gushed out or fell to the ground. When the old wineskin bursts, what happens to the wine? Comes gushing out. So how would you translate that if you're a translator? They have gushed out in the error of Balaam. Well, so basically what they've decided is that this is an emotion that has come so powerfully upon him that he is rushing. He is just absolutely, completely immersed in it. It's just pouring out. And so abandoned themselves, rushed headlong, ran riotously, run greedily, but literally it's poured out. So it's the metaphorical use of poured out, which must have been some kind of an idiom in their day for something that just bursts forth out from within that nobody even saw coming. And that is certainly true about what happened with Balaam. So that's the first word that we want to look at. The second word, reward, is just basically wages. When Jesus talked about someone who, the laborer is worthy of what? His hire. Okay, that's this word. And a day's wages in the parables, that's this word. So they're hoping for gaining something from this action. So it's got something to, it's tied to money. It's tied to money, it's tied to power. Yeah, Gray?
I'm sorry, what word did you say? Did you say lazy?
No, I said reward.
Reward.
Wages. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, wages and reward. Can you not hear me back there?
No.
Okay. Is that speaker not working?
No, it's okay. It's just his ears.
Oh. Okay. All right.
It's just him.
Okay.
What did you say, though?
Yeah,
right.
Okay. Then we have one final word, and that is error. And error is important because it identifies what Balaam did. And it's interesting, this word never means a mistake. Normally, if I'm at work and I do something wrong, could I say I made an error or I made a mistake? See, but they would never use this word for that. Matter of fact, this word's only used 10 times in the New Testament, and it's always used for false teaching or for false doctrine. And so when you look at it, if you look at the definitions, a mental straying or a wrong opinion. So these people have gushed out for a reward based on a false teaching or a false morality. So that's how he couches, or that's how he sets up Balaam. Now you remember with Cain, it was just a way, the way of Cain, a path of Cain. But for Balaam, he says that they rushed headlong, or they burst forth, or they gushed out into reward based on error. And that's going to be important as we go through here. So I think most of us remember the story of Balaam, but I kind of want to go step by step because there's a couple things that happen here in the beginning that will help us understand exactly what the way of Balaam is. I'm sorry, the error of Balaam is. And why do we need to know this? What does this help us identify? Well, they were marked out. Who was marked out? Who's the ones that are run riotously into the error of Balaam? False teachers, right? People in denominations today. People who want to hold a form of godliness, but do what? Deny its power. They don't want it to have any control over them. So Balaam is introduced by Balak as someone who can curse and be cursed or blessed and be blessed. What might have happened that they would think that? What does a prophet do sometimes regarding a nation that other people might think when he says they're going to be cursed, they're going to be cursed? Who sent him to make that proclamation?
God
did. It's like Jeremiah, or it's like Jonah. When God sent Jonah for Nineveh, if they hadn't repented, what would have happened in 40 days?
Destroyed.
And everybody would say, boy, when Jonah says something's going to happen, it happens. Well, that's what happens here. And Peter identifies him as a prophet. So this is a prophet, which we'd have to call him the last prophet of the patriarchal age. Because is he a prophet to Israel? No, he started away from Israel, probably before Israel was even Israel. And so Balaam is somebody outside, like Job, like Abraham, like Noah. He's a prophet that God has spoken. Because what is the patriarchal age? How do we describe the patriarchal age? God is telling people directly, right? So God calls Abraham a prophet. He calls Noah a prophet. He calls Enoch a prophet. Abel was a prophet. And now Balaam is a prophet. Now, Balak has heard about him. And so he wants to hire him. And so he sends some very important people and some kind of money, some kind of a reward. And Balaam goes to God. And God gives him two direct commands. Okay, in that little box on page 2. The first command, it's direct command, it's a specific command. And that is, you shall not go with them. Now, is that hard to understand? No, it's real simple. God made it clear you are not to go with them. And then what's the second thing they're not supposed to do? You cannot curse them because I have blessed them. So God has now revealed to Balaam the fate of the Israelites. I'm going to bless them. And you can't go, and you can't curse them. Now, once that happened, can Balaam help Balak in any way? What does Balak want? He wants him to come curse him. But what's Balaam going to have to do? If he even went, what would he have to do? He'd have to bless them. Is Balak going to be happy with that? Why would you want to put yourself between God and a king, with the king wanting you to do one thing and God wanting you to do something else? How's that going to come out for you? It's not going to come out well. So God's protecting his prophet. You can't go. Now, Balak doesn't take no for an answer. Now, we've talked about this in the past, but did Moab have anything to fear from Israel? Did they need to be cursed? Look at that verse at the bottom of page 2. The Lord said to me, do not harass Moab, nor contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession. So Balak's the king of Moab. And what has God already told Moses? Leave them alone. You cannot go in there. So Balak's all worried about Israel because Israel's destroying the Canaanites. But even if Balaam doesn't go, how's it going to turn out for Balak? Going to turn out fine. So this gives us a concept of the will of God. God is protecting Balaam. God is protecting Balak. If he would obey God, then Balaam wouldn't have gone and Balak would have come out fine. So that's what we don't always understand. When God tells us to do something or not to do something, you remember how God put it, how Moses put it, this is for our good always. So every command that God gives, whether we can understand it or not, every command God gives is in our best interests. But Balak doesn't know that. Balaam doesn't know that. So let's go ahead and turn to page 3. Balak sends more people and offers more reward. Now, what did God already told Balaam? You can't go. And you can't curse them. So this is the inception. This is the conception. You remember how God described sin in James chapter 1? Each man is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. And the enticement brings the temptation, and the temptation gives birth to sin. And when sin grows up, it brings death. Now, it's interesting because Balaam goes to God at night, and everything's fine. By the time he gets up and saddles his donkey, he's in the grip of madness. He is in the grip of sin, iniquity, and the angel of the Lord has come out to kill him because he's now an adversary. So what happened that night? He went from a godly prophet to a sinner. And let's give the benefit of the doubt. Let's say he got up late. Let's say within 18 hours or 12 hours or 16 hours, Balaam changed sides. Balaam, the error of Balaam started right here. Now, in the one key event is set forth right in the middle of page 3. It says, Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. Now, does that sound good? Yeah. But then he says, I'm going to go back to God and ask again. Now, do you see the problem with that? Did God make clear? You can't go. Why is he going back? See, he's doing what a lot of people do. We've seen this our whole life. Matthew 5, about the marriage, divorce, remarriage question. All of a sudden, when you find somebody in that situation, now what do we have to do? We've got to go back and restudy this. And by the time we're done, we've changed the teaching. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a question here. Could you say that Balaam was a double-minded man? A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Could you say at this point, right, get this?
Well, you see my two possible scenarios, one and two. One of them is, yes, he's a double-minded man. The other one is, he just got caught up. So let's look at these two scenarios. After the messengers came or left the first time, Balaam started to regret it. Balaam started thinking about what he could have had, how he might have been able to pull this off, how he could have probably gotten some of that money. And then when they came a second time, what happens? It just blows up. Because he set it up that way. But then the second is, he didn't give it a second thought, but their arrival and offer kindled some kind of a desire. So, Charles, I'd have to say that there's a good possibility he's a double-minded man, that God told him you can't go, but then he started thinking about everything he could get if he went. Ray?
God gave him instruction, just like Moses, you will go down. And then Moses says, I'm not a good speaker, well, I'm good. Cut you off if you don't.
Right.
Same
yeah.
Thing. Don't do this. And now he's using human reasoning. God will change his mind.
Yeah. That's exactly right. But the motivation is greed. Okay, we'll see that in just a few moments. But the motivation is greed. And so when we start to try to identify the error of Balaam, the error of Balaam starts when he says, I'm going to go back and ask again. Because what is he hoping for? God's already made himself clear. What is he hoping for?
God's going to change his mind.
Yeah, somehow. But does God change his mind? So Balaam is looking for a way to get what he wants and still obey God. Is that possible? It's not possible. Because Balak wants him to come and curse them. So even if God lets him go, what's going to happen when he gets there? He can't curse him. But what's Balak going to expect? So, as I said, you're setting yourself up for persecution. This is what people do. I often tell people, when you first start your job, if you hold a tight line and everybody knows where you stand, they're not going to be pushing you all the time. But if you start to compromise within the first couple of weeks, what are the people going to think? Yeah, this guy's not, he's easily pushable. And we set ourselves up sometimes, and that's exactly, once Balaam comes, what's Balak's expectation? I've offered to pay you if you curse the people. He comes, what do you expect of him? He's gonna do what he's told to do. And why would Balaam go? Why would Balaam want to put him in that kind of a position? Well, as Charles said, we got a problem now between faith, his faith in God, his trust in God. You remember Moses in Hebrews chapter 11, it says that he decided to suffer ill treatment with the people of God rather than to enjoy what? All the riches of Egypt. What about Balaam? Well, he went the other way. That's the error of Balaam. And we've all seen it in our lifetime. Preachers, godly members, who have been servants of God for years, and then something creeps up. You don't get to see it. By the time you see it, it's way too late. Because if they don't go to somebody when it first starts, or they don't get a handle on it, like we talked about Sunday morning in our sermon, about making sure you have landmarks all around you so you know where you are. And you can see, wait a minute, I'm straying away from where I'm supposed to be. I better get myself back. So Balaam here, but this all happens. I mean, this is like a flash, because he goes to God and God says, go with him. Now, why does God tell him to go with him?
That's what you want.
Okay, exactly. If you're going to drag yourself into this situation, and there's two possibilities here. I wrestled with this afternoon. The first possibility is God knew he was going to go no matter what. And so God told him, go ahead and go, but I'm going to guide you all the way, because if God guides him all the way, can he still come out of this okay, even though he can't handle this temptation? Or God knows he's going to fall no matter what he does. And so he's now become a vessel of wrath that Paul talked about in Romans chapter 1 that God is going to use to bring a blessing on his people. So those are the two possibilities. And I'm not sure which one it is, because Balaam doesn't ever come out of this. Brian?
Yeah, it kind of reminds us of the old prophet, you know, where he says, hey, I'm a prophet as well, and here's what God told me you should do. God had already told him what he wanted. The old prophet told him something separate, and it cost his life.
Right, and it did, and that prophet knew that. He lied to him, knowing, because he told Jeroboam, I can't come because God told me if I come home with you, I won't get to go home. I will die. So why the prophet do that? And that's the whole point. There are some people who couldn't care less about your spiritual well-being. There are people out there who don't care about you at all. And, you know, those of us who are righteous and loving, can we conceive of people like that, that would do something like that? See, we can't even conceive of it.
Yeah.
That there be people out there that way. And we give the benefit of the doubt, the benefit of the doubt. Well, this is why the error of Balaam is so important. Because there are people out there who would sell your soul, your eternal destiny, for their comfort in this life. And know it. I mean, let's face it. Does Balaam not know there's a God?
He definitely knows.
He definitely knows there's a God. Does God not know that Israel is his people, that he's going to bless? And yet, knowing that, he still tries to use his own knowledge to bring about their destruction. And we saw this during the 50s. I mean, there were some preachers out there. We don't know who they were, because you can't read people's hearts. But some of them knew what they were doing was a violation of God's law, but they didn't care because they felt that the benefits that they would receive would outweigh that. And I guess some of them comforted themselves with the idea that if we bring more people into the church, God's ultimately going to be glorified. But what's the fallacy of that?
You're buying false teaching.
Yeah, and are you bringing people to God if you teach them false doctrine? No, you're doing just the opposite. All right, so Balaam knew the truth, but he wanted to do something else. Now, godly and devout people crush that. They crush it because they understand the end is the way of death. And that's what all of us here, I hope, do with all of these things. You know, even if you have a weakness that you're struggling with, if you repent in tears every time you do it, are you in danger of what Balaam did? So you're not in danger of that, because you're not looking for a way to do it without having to repent. But as I point out in the notes here at the very bottom of page 3, multitudes of people have followed Balaam. They know God has forbidden something, but they still want to get as close as they can to it. And that's why Paul says, you see Romans 13 here? Put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. Now, that's what Balaam did. Balaam was looking for a way to fulfill his lust. Paul?
Yeah, when I was living in Germany, we had a Wednesday night study on alcohol. And there's a lot of members of the church that just, they wanted a line drawn because of Paul's instruction of Timothy about alcohol. There's got to be a line somewhere because, you know, Timothy was allowed to cut a little line with his water for whatever. But, you know, that was a dangerous line across. And I can't believe that there's people having that stumbling block. But that's exactly what you're talking about here, is that, you know, people want, you know, their ears tickled or whatever. They want something to answer to their satisfaction so that they can please God and have right. their way as well.
Yeah, and if you read those two Proverbs, is there any way you can come to the conclusion that God doesn't care about alcohol? Wine and alcohol are two entirely different things. Yeah. Some wine has alcohol, some wine doesn't. And throughout the Old Testament, he talks about the blessings of wine. Well, if he's talking about the blessings of wine, what kind of wine is it?
Non-alcoholic.
Because the moment when it says, look not at the cup, because in the end, your eyes are going to get red. Well, can your eyes get red if you're drinking pure grape juice?
No.
You're not going to get red. And you're going to speak things you don't know, and you're going to be beaten and not even know it. What are we talking about?
That's right.
Alcohol. Then they say, well, Jesus turned water into 180 gallons of alcohol. Can you imagine what kind of a wedding that would have been? I mean, the terrible things that would have happened? Jesus wouldn't do that. But if you want alcohol to be okay, can you find enough verses in there to weave it together and make your case? Yeah, and they do. And there's, you know, you almost can't pry them away from it, but just remember the way of Balaam. God made it clear. He said, do not look at alcohol. It is going to sting. It's going to bite like a serpent, sting like an adder. And so, yeah, that's a good point, Paul. All right. Now, there's another question. Why did God let him go? We just kind of answered that. Either he was going to go and God wanted to help him, or God knew he was a lost cause and he was going to use him. And I think that the latter may be the case, because after he saw the angel of the Lord with a drawn sword, what did he say? I'll go home if you want. What did God say? What did the angel say? You're going to go now and you're going to say what I say, what I tell you to say. All right. So, as I said, God... Let's look at that next verse, which is toward the middle of page 4. God's anger was aroused because he went. Well, wait a minute. He said, rise up and go. Why was he angry? Well, Balaam wasn't the same guy anymore. The guy that went to God in the beginning was not rushing headlong. He was not mad. He was not insane. He was not out of his mind. He was not an adversary. But when he got up in the morning, as Peter said, the dumb donkey rebuked him for what? Iniquity. And stopped the what? The madness. Now, once David knew Bathsheba was somebody's wife, what's the next logical step? Oops, I better go find one of my wives. Because Paul talks about that. It's better to marry than to burn. And that's why he gives those commands in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 about the wife not having power over her body and the man not having power over his body. Because what happens when people reach a certain point in burning? They will start looking elsewhere. And to keep that from happening, David could. He had a way of escape. But there was a madness now. There was a madness. And so God's anger came because in one night, lust joined with enticement gave birth to temptation, gave birth to sin, and the sin grew up. So how quickly can it happen?
Overnight.
See, and that's the error of Balaam, and that's what we have to be so careful about. So, now, the fact that the angel of the Lord was an adversary, I just want to look at one verse. I've got three verses here in the middle of page 4, but let's just look at the middle one. I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him, obey his voice, do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies, and I will be an adversary to your adversaries. Now when the angel of the Lord comes out against Balaam, he's an adversary. What's that telling us? What's the necessary inference? If the angel of the Lord is an adversary of Balaam, and the angel of the Lord is an adversary to all the adversaries of Egypt, of Israel, what does that tell us about Balaam?
Balaam's an adversary.
Now he's an adversary. Now if he's an adversary, what is that telling us about what his intention is when he gets there? God's mad at him for going. He's mad. He's insane. He is in the grips of iniquity, and the angel of the Lord has come out as an adversary and then tells him, your way is perverse before me. So 2 and 2 equals 4, right? Where's he at now? See, he's completely gone. So we've gone from a prophet who speaks to God to a man who is going to destroy God's people for his own personal gain overnight. So can that happen to a preacher if it happened to Balaam? Can we have a gospel preacher who is sound and teaching the truth, and then overnight he becomes something else? Can that happen? And if it happens, people got to pick up on it, because now he's come in secretly, and if it's not dealt with, what's going to happen? Church is going to suffer tremendously. So the angel of the Lord, God's mad. The angel of the Lord is an adversary. He's in iniquity. He's in error. And his plan is to destroy Israel, to curse Israel somehow, because I want that reward. And as Peter puts it, or as Jude puts it, it gushed out. And doesn't it kind of look like that? I mean, we go from a normal man who's a prophet to a madman who is rushing. And when the donkey starts talking to him, what would you do if a donkey started talking to you? Would you? Whoa, wait a minute. There's something seriously going on here. This donkey is talking. What does Balaam do? He's out of his mind. He is so controlled by his lust that he's not even thinking. Now, when he sees the angel of the Lord with that sword drawn, then what happens? Man, the madness has gone in a heartbeat. And we've all seen this. You've got people out there, they have a near-death experience, and they call you up, man, I'm going to repent, and I'm going to do everything right, and I'm really sorry. 3 weeks later, where are they? Right back where they were. Because, well, yeah, but you're an exception. You're not the rule. I've talked with lots of people, near-death experiences, but as that fades away, it's just like the children of Israel. As they saw each plague, as God brought each act of power, what were they saying? God, we trust God. We love God. But what does the Hebrew writer say? It was never joined with what in Hebrews chapter 3 and 4? Never joined with faith. They never got the message. Faith comes by hearing, but they never heard. All right, so let's keep going here. Let's kind of summarize. Balaam is a prophet in the service of God. He knows God intimately. He knows God's will. He knows God's people. He understands the nature of what he's involved in. But when the reward got high enough, the lust came. The enticement, the temptation, the sin, the perversity. And this is what we're looking for. This is how a prophet is marked out. This is how a false prophet is marked out. And if it starts gushing out, are you going to pick up on it at some point? See it? You're going to see it. And I think we can see it in most of the denominations today as they get further and further from God's word. And you try to figure out, why in the world are they doing this? Why are the Presbyterians and all these different denominations changing their views on homosexuality, on drinking, on abortion, on lots of these things? Why are they doing that? See, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's a reason. And the reason is, if they don't, what's going to happen to all their members? They're going to leave. And what happens to their power structure? What happens to their financial situation? See, this is a problem that Prince has been dealing with. As he comes in and preaches to the people, if they show any interest at all, are they? Is he a threat to the denominational preacher who's getting his money because he has those people? That's never going to go away because of the way of Balaam. These people aren't preaching because of the love of the truth. They're preaching because, like Balaam, they're wanting a reward. All right, let's go ahead and turn to page 5. All right, Balaam confesses his sin. I've sinned. And I didn't know you were standing there. Is that the right answer? I didn't know you were standing there? Is that the reason why he sinned? No. So, exactly. We got worldly sorrow here, right? We got that same kind of sorrow in 2 Corinthians. Worldly sorrow versus godly sorrow. This is worldly sorrow. I didn't know you were there. I didn't know you were about to kill me. Well, that's the least of his worries. So, I've sinned, and if it's displeasing to you, boy, that's a shocker. I mean, I don't know. If it's displeasing to you, I will go back. Well, God says, you're going. Now, I'm going to skip over these two verses, but, whatever a man sows, what's it going to happen? If you sow to the flesh, you're going to reap corruption. Did Balaam sow to the flesh? Now, most people, it takes years to reap this corruption. How quickly did he get it?
Overnight.
That's how fast it can happen. And he did exactly what that next verse is. Is he now unequally yoked with Balak? Yeah, he's tied to Balak now. The fact that he shows up is the necessary inference. If you call somebody and say, look, I want you to do something for me, and they show up, what's your necessary inference?
They're going to do
it for you. So when they come and they do just the opposite, what do you think? What's going on here? I told you to come and curse them. You bless them. He's angry. So, and that's exactly what happened. I've skipped over that. You can read through it in Numbers 22 and 23, how he blesses Israel. But I just want you to notice Balak's anger was aroused against Balaam. And he says in verse 11, very important, right in the middle of page 5, now therefore flee to your place. I said I would greatly honor you, but the Lord has held you back from honor. Now does that sting? Is that hurtful? The Lord has held you back from the honor I wanted to give you. Well, that, is that true? Is that a lie? That's a lie. He didn't hold him back from honor. He tried to keep him from going there in the first place. Balak's honor was worthless. Just like if Moses had said, I can't go with God because I need the honor from Pharaoh. Well, that wouldn't end well. All right, so there's three verses here, or four verses that we need to look at to kind of tie it together, because the last verse of verse 25, right in the middle of the page, Balaam arose, departed, and returned to his place. Now, if it had ended there, would everything be fine? But it didn't end there. All right, so let's go ahead and read these next verses. Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove. The people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifice of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and those who died in the plague were 24,000. Now is that a pretty good curse to get 24,000 of your enemies put to death in one day? So that was a terrible thing. But then, in the next verse, they harassed you with their schemes. Where did these schemes come from? Well, there's the next verse. These women caused the children of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor. And then Jesus, bluntly, plainly, in Revelation chapter 2, talking to one of the churches, says, I have a few things against you because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit sexual immorality. Now, sexual immorality is so often the vehicle that gets people into idolatry. I mean, idolatry in and of itself, is there anything in it for you? But if you change the laws to make it what you want, then is there something in it for you? So Balaam has changed sides. He's become an adversary. Now he's gotten 24,000 of the Jewish people put to death because of his schemes. So here we have a man who knows God's will, who knows God's people, who knows what the temptations of God's people are. And what does he give Balaam? He gives him all that information. Balaam, or Balak, I'm sorry, that's why he didn't answer. What does he give Balak? He gives them all the secret dealings of how the members of Israel are weak and how they can be tempted. Brian?
Yeah, we see, I mean, you know, the wisest man ever, Solomon, his heart was turned because of women. And that's why God didn't want them to multiply wives to themselves. He knew what would happen to their hearts.
Yeah, that's exactly
right.
It's
just right. It repeats itself all throughout history, right?
Right. Okay, we got just a couple seconds here. We really don't have much time, but let's make a couple applications on page 6. Because this didn't go away. In Galatians chapter 4, verse 17, they zealously court you, but for no good thing. They want to exclude you, that you will be zealous for them. All right, so that's part of the error of Balaam. The next one. Also from among yourselves, men will arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away the disciples after themselves. And then the next one in 2 Peter 2. In covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise out of you. So the error of Balaam is the ability to take the scriptures and twist them to destroy God's people in order to gain some kind of a financial or power advantage. You know, I've often thought about the Catholic priests during the Middle Ages accepting all the confessions, the inner secrets of all the people in that community. You think they could use that information if they wanted to for their own ends? And get power over the people and use the people for money or power or sexual favors. I mean, they could do whatever they wanted. They could find out some young girl confesses this particular sin regarding a sexual thing, and then now can he use that? And now he knows this weakness? It just makes me want to throw up sometimes to think about how terrible that doctrine is, that the priest gets to hear all of the wickedness of God's people. But that's one of their doctrines. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there, and we're going to move to Korah next week. Any questions or thoughts before we close the class? All right, appreciate everybody's comments, and this is a disgusting class. It's so sad. Balaam lost his soul. 24,000 Israelites lost their soul because of the wickedness, and that's the error of Balaam. And there's a lot of people out there who are gushing out with it because it's so important to them. All right. Thanks a lot, everybody.